back to Hype Podcast. This is Hypeable.com's flagship show, where we bring you all the latest news and entertainment and pop culture and analysis every week. We've got another special for you guys. We just could not stay away from Cursed Child. We have recorded two other specials for the 8th Harry Potter story in the past, but now that a bunch of us have finally experienced the story in book form, we really need to come back and do one more special for you guys. So for those of you guys that are just tuning in for the first time, like we said, we are Hypeable.com's flagship show. We talk about everything from movies and TV to music and books. On our weekly episodes, we do release episodes every week. So if you like what you hear, we really, really hope that you stick around and hang out with us during one of our regular episodes. We're going to jump right in and introduce our panel. My name is Pamela. I can't remember if I said that or not. I'm going to host the show for you guys today. I'm one of the regular hosts on Hype, and I also have another regular host with me, Kyle. Hey, Kyle, how's it going?
Hello.
Kyle is has been really nice, and he's like, I'll come and talk about Cursed Child with you, because I feel like you've been on all the other specials, so this is going to be fun.
Yeah. Because
you've actually seen it. You've seen the play, so he's like our play expert.
Yeah, and it's actually really helpful.
Is it? Yeah, no, it totally is. That's why we wanted to get either you or Selena on, because you guys have both seen the play. And we also have some special guests with us today. We have Andrea, who used to work on Hypeable, so she's kind of like no stranger to this stuff. So do you just want to say hi and like introduce yourself and all that good stuff?
Yeah, so it's been a while. But yeah, I wrote for Hypeable for a couple years there. It's been, I think, 3 years since that time. But I've been trying to keep up and excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Of course. And then we also have Mr. Eric Skull joining us, who many of you might recognize from MuggleCast. How's it going?
Hello, everybody. Going all right. Going all right.
Good.
Just finished this new Harry Potter story yesterday.
You took your time with it then.
Well, kind of. We had a con to get back from.
Oh, that's right.
It was GeekyCon over the weekend, so a lot of Sunday was spent paneling and in immediate sort of reaction. I was on a reaction panel, Leaky Mug, with Andrew Sims and Melissa Anelli, John Noe, and Fracco, before I even passed part one. So now, but now I'm all red, so I can talk about it. I'm excited.
That's actually very impressive. Yeah, let's talk about that. I mean, did anybody go to like midnight releases or anything? I know that obviously like, you were at KikiCon. I can't even imagine like the excitement there because that's where all the Potter fans are.
Yeah, the excitement of that was came in that we all got the books at. It was sort of KikiCon threw their own midnight release party. So it was actually, it works out because the book was obviously released Saturday at midnight or into Sunday, and Saturday nights are typically the S. Earl Rockin' Charity Ball. And so the ball turned into the party. So everybody was already dressed up really nice, and everybody was dancing. There was DJs. There was sort of live stuff on stage. And then at midnight, when we could get the books, everybody just kind of lined up and did that. So it was really special seeing it with like an audience of 500 people or so.
That's so awesome. Yeah. I'm so sad I missed that, but it also makes me so happy that it's still happening. You know, it just reminds me of the good old days.
It makes
that was the big, yeah, that was the big point.
It makes me sad though, because Kristen, one of the writers on Hypeable, said that she, Karen went to a party and it was so boring because it was all aimed towards children that they left. And they had to get their books later.
So we're old now.
I know. That's what made me so sad. I was like, oh, Harry Potter release parties aren't as fun anymore, apparently. Or some could be, and then some, I guess, are just for children.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't go the whole time, but I did go pick my book up at midnight from Barnes & Noble, my local Barnes & Noble, holding it down for all the midnight releases across the country. But there was not very much to do at mine. I don't know if, like, they sent more materials to the ones that had more, like, pre-orders or what. Like, that would make sense from a financial standpoint. But mine didn't have very much. But then I saw, like, my other friends who had gone to other parties across the country, like they seemed to have more than we did. So it looks like it, like some had better turnouts than others basically, which is good. Like it makes me so happy. I was shocked by how many younger children there are, but it also makes me happy because it's like, oh, Potter is living on through the younger generation, and it's not just us like oldies hanging out. So that's nice.
I like that we're oldies in what, like mid 20s, early 30s, probably.
I know. Speak for yourself. But yeah, I actually, it's pretty funny because I think Harry Potter parties have always been a little cursed in the way that they were not cursed with the Cursed Child release, but just geared towards children. I think institutions. I was actually at a movie release once, and it's a story for another time. But it was so much geared towards young children that I left with a very bad taste in my mouth. But I got to see the new. It was Chamber of Secrets at the time, so I was okay with it. But they had like trivia and stuff, and they were giving away posters, but the trivia questions were like, who is Harry's redheaded friend? And like, I could have told you everything about Ron Weasley, his birthday, his full name, everything, all of his siblings, but it wasn't for me. And a child, like an 8-year-old, walked away with the poster.
Oh.
So I guess I said the story was for another time, then I went and told it, but it's kind of sad. I'm never quite, actually, you know what I did? I complained to management and got a poster and walked away, but, you know, you'll never get away from, I think, bookstores really interesting that, younger generation.
Right. And it's interesting though, because when Joe announced that this was going to be a script, like we always knew it was going to be a script, but you would think that it would be harder for younger kids to get into. So I wasn't really sure like who was going to be picking up this book, to be honest with you, when I walked
in.
Yeah. So I was like pleasantly surprised, but like, let's get into that. We've all read the script by now, except for Kyle, who's a cool kid and he's gone to see the play. So like no need, but I want to hear.
Kyle, so you didn't read?
So the thing with the script is that this is the rehearsal edition. So I have taken a look at it, and I spent like a good 15-20 minutes like looking at all the scenes that I remember and like seeing how like the stage directions and stuff. But everything is exactly the same. My friend who saw the play also bought the script, and she read the whole thing, and she was like, "Yeah, it's literally like just word for word everything." That.
Okay, well, you must have good memory then, because the stuff I'm about to talk about.
I do. I do remember almost everything about the play. So, except there's one tidbit that someone tweeted me about, and I've asked Andrew and three other people who've seen the play, and none of us can remember how they pulled something off, but we'll get to that.
That's what we're here for, because, you know, well, at least in book format. Let's just go around the room and talk about initial reactions. I want to know specifically, like, if you had gotten spoiled on purpose, like, if you chose to or by accident, and then also, like, if that tainted the way that you saw the story after you read it, if you did or didn't get spoiled, or if you didn't get spoiled. I want to know it all. So, any takers? Who wants to go first?
I'll go. So I was not spoiled, I don't think at all. I think all I had kind of heard was made that like Scorpius and Albus were friendly, but I really knew nothing. So it was kind of exciting for me. I had also heard just from like random people's reactions to the play that they weren't too sure about it. I don't know that I got like raving reviews, but so I went in just kind of not really knowing the plot at all. And my reaction is mixed, I guess. Like I objectively don't know that I think it's great, but I.
That was the most diplomatic way you could have said that.
I enjoyed reading it. Like, so I think that's why I'm having a hard time, is because like I don't know that the content is great for me, but I had a lot of fun reading it, if that makes sense.
I really think we need to separate the excitement that we have as Harry Potter fans, as long-term Harry Potter fans, of getting and reading a new Harry Potter book in some way. We have to separate that excitement from the content of the book and how we feel about what's in the book. I think that's probably more difficult to do than it is to say, but I'm seeing a lot of, you know, criticism, a lot of feedback from people who are like, oh, it was a great play. Reading it made me feel so warm and fuzzy because it's a new Harry Potter book. And I was like, well, are you actually commenting on the content of the play? Because I don't feel that it's that good. I did spoil myself beforehand. Right when the first preview performance came up and the details emerged, I voraciously searched Tumblr and local websites for spoilers. I wanted to know the details. Actually, really, what I just wanted to know was general, was it good? Was it bad kind of thing? But it obviously became a rabbit hole of detail. And so I was sort of trying to mentally prepare myself. I was able to actually, going in to the release party, separate, you know, the excitement from the content. It's basically like I said to myself, okay, because I was preparing not to like the play once I read it. So I was like, I'm going to have all the fun I can at the release party, and which I did. It was an amazing evening. But then when I got the book and went back to the hotel room, I'm like, okay, it's time to like hunker down and actually like just put my frowny face on and kind of wade through something that I'm not going to like. So that was it for me. I didn't really have the joy experience of reading new Harry Potter content, because once I got into it, and within the first, I don't know, 20 pages, I read in a group in a hotel room, and all of us longtime Harry Potter fans reading were just sort of, what? Kind of the whole way through the first couple scenes. So, I mean, overall impressions are, to me, it doesn't feel like Harry Potter. And it's different. It's not just the simple difference between reading a book and reading a play. I understand. I've read plays before. Okay, it's not just that. These characters, to me, don't feel like the characters that we last left 19 years ago, or 9 years ago.
It's really interesting. I've heard a lot of reviews from people who've read the book, and they're like, it doesn't feel like Harry Potter at all. And sitting in the theater, if you guys ever get a chance to see it, and I'm always going to be that voice of reason, but that voice of like, go see it because it's awesome. But it felt like Harry Potter when I was there. And it's the characterization, I think the actors did a really good job on resembling the characters from the books. Ron was spot on, and Hermione was great. But it's so interesting because to people who don't read the script, it doesn't feel like Harry Potter. I know you said because of the script, because it's in script format. Maybe that's why it doesn't feel like Harry Potter for some people, because it's just so odd. But in the theater, it felt like I was like back in those days.
I like that magic was there for you. Like, it makes me so happy to know that, because if it ever comes to San Francisco and I have like the funds, because theater can get expensive, I would love to go see what they do with the stage production, because it's a different way to digest it. But I have to agree with Eric a little bit on this, and it's not necessarily because it was in script format that I felt it was a little off. I think that, like, you know, the book opens with that 19 years later epilogue. And when I read that, I felt like instantly like emotional, like this emotional pull, because you're coming back into the world that you know. And that was so much verbatim what Joe had written that you didn't feel it. But as I kept going on, like, there were certain characters who's just like their voices. And I understand it's really hard to write the way Joe writes. It just didn't feel to me like genuine. I didn't feel like I was reading like specifically Ron when Ron was talking. Mm-hmm. Maybe Ron more towards like the movies, that is like this lovable goofball, but like book Ron was never that kind of daft, basically.
That's exactly what I like. And it's interesting hearing Kyle say, oh, watching him in the play felt like book Ron. Are you sure you didn't mean movie Ron? Because he reads a lot like movie Ron. He reads a lot like comic relief. He makes dad jokes. He's relegated to,
oh my god, he's the ultimate dad. Thank you.
he's really relegated to comic relief again, and it's such a movieism to do that. To it really betrays his book character, in my opinion.
Oh yeah, I think I can understand that you think it's very hard to say, because If you think about it, book version versus movie version, I think it definitely, he took the part of movie Ron more so, especially with the fact that he didn't really help with the plot in any way, shape, or form. He was just kind of there.
Right.
But Yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe I am likening him to movie Ron instead of book Ron.
Well, I wonder. This is why I want to know. I mean, this is why I think it's essential. And Kyle, when you have time, please read this book, because it. I really want to know if everyone who did see it and is still having good feelings about it isn't sort of. I mean, look, it's obviously the way that this play is meant to be experienced is on stage, and for many, many very cool reasons, it's seeming like it's a can't-miss production. Stagecraft, the magic, the acting. It seems like they got top-notch quality people to act out, to perform, to do visual effects. The music I hear is great. We didn't hear an ounce of, who is it? Not Ingrid Michaelson. Who does the music?
Heap.
I mean, Imogen Heap. None of that transfers in the book, so sure, fine. But it seems like the production is absolutely 100% can't miss. Even though I don't care for this script, I would still probably see the play if I could, because it gives off the sense of being insanely technically ambitious, and that they could achieve something this complex is pretty impressive, to be honest. But I still... You know, most of the world, even if this play tours, most of the world is still only going to have this book to go off of. And I don't think the story is strong, and I don't think that it's fair to call it the 8th Harry Potter story, and I certainly don't think it's fair to call it canon. Sorry if there's a lot of, like, thoughts in there.
That's important. It's a big point, because, I mean, her name is obviously on it, and so, you know, she's clearly approved of this, but it doesn't feel like she... had much of a role in it. Kind of felt to me like somebody had said, hey, look at my fanfic. And she said, yeah, sure. It kind of matches with what I had thought, maybe. But it's not really as authentic as I would have hoped it would be, I guess.
Right. And you know, it's funny because I was talking to somebody else about this, and I wonder if somebody who is not as inundated in online fan culture as we are would see that, or would just see this as like a great story. Because if you are familiar with fanfic, like Andrea was alluding to, like, you know that time travel is like a trope that's been around since the dawn of Harry Potter fanfiction time. So just to see it as being dubbed like this 8th Harry Potter story, where it's like something that I feel like we've seen time and time again if we've read fanfic, it's kind of like, all right. Like, you would expect something more original, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, didn't Joe like write in Pottermore that, you know, she'd gotten rid of them for a reason?
Well, yeah, she did, actually. But that's something that, you know, in actually thinking about sort of like the main reasons that stick out for why I didn't like it, like, it also has a part of it is trying to get over my own expectations going in, because I think for all of us who have been fans for a really long time, like, the expectations for this play were like abominably high, you know, so impossibly high, maybe even, in terms of what we were hoping for. And I think for me, you know, my main expectations going in were that the story would probably be set entirely in the future, entirely in the 19 years later era, and focus, you know, basically just on Harry, you know, trying to be a good parent. I was not expecting time travel. I was not expecting to see Umbridge and Snape and Dumbledore again. And by the way, when you do see all these characters again, it feels cheap and knockoffy to me. But just the idea that time travel should be used, and as you're saying, like, overused. Like, time travel, J.K. Rowling wrote it once. It's one of the best sequences in all of the Harry Potter series in Prisoner of Azkaban. But that's sort of where it belongs. If you use it again, you're using it too much. And certain plot points, certain problems can be solved immediately if somebody has a time turner. So that's why she got rid of it. That's why she got rid of them all. And so, okay, the main plot of this play is there's a time turner, and Albus and Scorpius use it. Fine. But it's not even that, okay? It's really not, because when that time turner gets destroyed, there's a second time turner that they use to go back and make everything right again. And damn it, that's too many.
it's very true, though.
Yeah, I mean, it does read like a loop. Yeah, it is like that Deus Ex Machina situation, right? The time turner can fix or muddle everything. So it is interesting. I do, since we're on the subject of time turners, I want to talk a little bit about the plot, because one of the things that really stuck out to me after I got over that initial reaction, I think everybody feels when you get like a new Harry Potter story in your hand, like you want to love it so much. There are some aspects that I like enjoyed, but you know, there was also a lot that was wrong with this for me personally. This idea that they needed to, like, Albus and Scorpius needed to go back to the events of Goblet of Fire, like, to save Cedric of all people. Did we feel like that was particularly forced? Like, would it have made more sense for them to try and save somebody that was closer to Harry, like Remus, yes, or even Sirius?
It made absolutely no sense. And when they had mentioned that, I sat in my seat and was like, what? Me and Selena looked at each other. We were like, the hell is going on here? And the more I think about it, if they wanted to bring anyone back, or if they wanted that to be the motivation for time travel, they should have had Teddy be in the play and have him be like, I miss my dad, and like, I hate that I don't get to see either of my parents, and I want them back. And then when they discover the time turner, that's what he uses it for.
Like, definitely would have had more of an emotional attachment to
we're all connected to Remus. Yeah. But I mean, it's kind of like, it's really the same thing no matter who you want to bring back. And Harry really fails as a human being to illustrate why you can't just go and muddle with time. Like, I feel like maybe he's weak because of Amos Diggory. He's not expecting this sudden realization by Cedric's father 22 years later or 25 years after the fact. You know, he's just not expecting to be approached, but ultimately I think everyone understands that's not something that you can prevent. You know, Cedric's death, as heartbreaking as it is, trust me, I'm a Hufflepuff, okay? He's the only good one in the books. I would love for him to have survived, but it was absolutely essential that he did not. And this is not something you can just go change, no matter what. And, you know, does it feel forced? Yes, it feels forced. It also feels a little preposterous. That over the course of time, we're talking 22 years of grieving, that this should be the catalyst for this play set 19 to 22 years later for Amos to come back. I'm not saying you ever get over your son's death, okay? Not trying to say that. But to the point of actively berating Harry and saying you're not doing enough and just really pursuing the issue, it was a little much to me. I think that J.K. Rowling has written characters that are much stronger, and like getting over death makes them stronger. And really, this is not Amos Diggory right now. And so it wasn't the Amos Diggory that I knew from the books coming. And there is, to be fair, a certain questionable extent by which he's being imperious or confounded by Delphi, a character who should never have existed. So it's possible that he doesn't really feel this way, but I think, based on the ending scene with him later in the play, he does still feel this way. And that just, to me, seems unlikely.
Right. And that is one of the reasons why I kind of feel like, because they wanted to force this idea of Voldemort's daughter, and they needed to have like something for her to do. So therefore, like, of course she'd want her dad to come back because she's as evil as he is and blah, 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 blah. But it's almost like the only way they could think to do this was to make them go back to when Voldemort first became like his corporeal form again. I mean, can we think of any other instances that they could have gone back to? Did it have to be Goblet of Fire?
Oh, yeah. I immediately thought of several instances where they're like, why are you going to this point instead of, like, I don't know, going to the cemetery scene where Cedric died and then just like killing Harry then and there and like, bam, you're done. Like,
yeah.
Story.
Well, and even within this whole idea, like, why go back to the first task and not the last one, like, from the get-go? Like, if we're mm-hmm. accepting this, you know, concept in the first place, like, I would have immediately gone to the last one.
Well, I wonder, because things do change, now it's time to actually cite the play that we've been avoiding. But the first time that they go back, it's, remember, Delphi kind of was, I think Delphi was thinking she was going with, but then Albus and Scorpius, who totally bought into the mission as they know it, have decided to go without her, so she can't go. Like, I wonder if they wouldn't, in fact, have, you know, gone somewhere else if Delphi were in control of the time turner.
That's a good point. I also, you know, to be honest with you, when they just started going back to the tasks, I was expecting Albus to learn something about Harry that maybe Harry hadn't divulged, because I think, like, we can all relate to parents being cagey about their past, and I can understand why Harry would want to be cagey about his, you know, despite the fact there's, like, millions of things that have been written about him. But I was kind of expecting something like that to happen, and then for it to have, like, never have happened kind of fell flat. Like, if Albus is going back and, like, seeing his dad and at his age, basically, I was just kind of expecting for, like, a little more, I guess, understanding, because there is so much, like, push and pull between Albus and Harry. Does that make sense?
Definitely. I mean, and I think that along with that, it's all of these scenes, obviously this is a script, it's a play, but they didn't go deep enough. It felt like it was all very rushed, and, like, they never really got too involved. You know,
it's that 5 minute limit on the time turner. You can go back 25 years, but only right. 5 minutes.
Which is convenient, yeah.
Doesn't make any sense. I'm sorry, Dustin.
Kyle, I want to ask you, since you've seen the play, in the script, they do this thing where anytime they're talking about, like, the time turner being used, it's like time is forced, and then it stops, and then it ponders, and then it pushes you through. Like, how does that transpire on the stage?
On the stage, they basically had a projection set up where it was really one of the coolest things, where they had basically the exact image of the background. So, like, they reproduced the background in, like, I assume in, like, a Photoshop thing or something. And they had it projected onto the back of the stage, so you never would realize that it's a projection. And when the time travel happens, they have ripples in the projection. So it's rippled
kind
of like the castle. And so,
cool.
Like, when I say castle, wow, I mean a castle at Disneyland, because I'm ridiculous. Like, if you've ever been to Disneyland or seen the light show where, like, they project things on buildings, it's like that. It's exactly like that.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay. Because it was, like, the way that they chose to describe it, I'm sure Eric and Andrea will remember this because it happens, like, many times in the book.
Much.
Was so interesting. And if you get a chance to flip through, you should, like, look at that, the way that they describe it, because I thought it was just an interesting way to set the scene. Like, if for anybody that's read scripts, you'll know that they have, like, you get stage directions and then also kind of, like, a description of what's going down. And I always thought that one was interesting while I was reading the book. But that sounds cool. See, I feel like it's almost kind of like when Joe meant that this was meant to be digested, like, in this form, she meant that, like, in conjunction with the play, it works. Because I could see, like, if you were sitting, like, in the theater and watching this unfold, like, it would add what the book does not. And it might have been just easier to digest. Like, the idea might have been easier to digest. Because you guys all, like, the Team Hypeable that went, you were all fairly pleased with the first part, right?
Oh, yeah. We walked out of the first part, like, thinking it was a ridiculous plot still. But still, we're like, okay, that was pretty cool. I have my moments. I don't like, we hated Delphi. Like, me and Selena were like, Delphi's got to go. Right at the end of Act 1, or part one, rather. So it was interesting. And I think that's why I didn't read it for this conversation, is because it felt like, if I had read it, it wouldn't have changed my outcome of what I thought of the play. Because the play is so ingrained to my head, and the visuals and everything else is so ingrained in my head. I would be reading the play, and it would be like I'm just imagining it all over again.
I mean, I could see how the spectacle of it could distract you enough to kind of pull you back in, even when you're thinking of this ridiculous plot. I could see how the lights and the, you know,
and
would
I
be
did
cool.
And I did read, like, a few pages, like, I think 15-20 pages of particular Albus and Scorpius moments, just because everyone was saying how they had felt the relationship between them be so strong. And I looked at the directions that they were told, like the stage directions and, like, the emotions that they were supposed to feel, and I was very surprised that, like, the emotion and everything was in the script as well, and it wasn't just on stage. So, like, that was surprising to me.
So let's talk about some of the new generation of characters that we do get introduced to, because this is the first time that we're basically meeting them. We get, you know, this tiny little snapshot at the end of Deathly Hallows, but it's really not enough. So let's start with Rose. I think that she was the character that surprised me most. I thought she was really be a little bit more of a ride or die type of a girl, but she just kind of like ditches her cousin straight off the bat. Did we kind of expect that from her? Because we kept hearing, like, you know, little tidbits like, oh, she's like the perfect mix of Ron and Hermione, and you would just expect her to be more loyal in that. Or maybe I just would have expected her to be more loyal.
She's barely in the play.
Yeah, so. I'm honestly also surprised she wasn't sorted into Slytherin with how she was acting and how and how like mean she was being to everyone. And the fact that she was there for 5 minutes, I was like, what is this about? Like, you put out a portrait of someone, like, they put out the promotional image of her for 5 minutes. Like, what was the point of that?
It's a bit of misdirection, really. I don't think that there's any other thing to call it. You know, this play is not about Rose. This story is not about Rose. But I think also what it was an entrance. They were trying to get people who were familiar with the characters. I mean, if you think about it, these children are only mentioned in the epilogue, which is the very last bit of this of the last Harry Potter book. So for the casual viewer who's not, you know, up and up, I really don't think having photos of Albus Severus Potter, you know, Rose Granger Weasley, Scorpius Malfoy, are really going to resonate with most people. So maybe it's, you know, they went for it anyway. Because the people who will know that they have, you know, that they'll recognize the main characters, the Harry, the Ron, the Hermione, the Ginny. But, like, you know, in having a photo of the family, you kind of realize that there are going to be children in the play, you know?
So, Kyle, was she that hardcore in the show? Or, like, was there any part, I mean, she's not in it very much, but of that, you know, that you noticed that she maybe was more of a Ron than anything? Because she seemed to me like she took more from her mom and much harsher as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. She was totally, like, cutthroat towards Scorpius. Like, she absolutely didn't care what his personality was like. She didn't. Like, she gave him side eye, like, every scene that they were in together. And so.
Oh, man. So, you know, and the play tries to set them up.
Yeah, I know. It was so ridiculous. She's so mean towards him. And that's why I have such a problem with Scorpius having a crush on her, and especially wanting to ask her out at the end of the play. I'm like, she is so mean and doesn't want anything to do with them. And then that happens.
But do you think this is, like, an early Hermione thing, you know, where, like, the guys didn't really like her much because she was kind of annoying to them, but, like, really, Hermione's awesome?
Well, I would say that if this story and this play was in the span of 1 year, but the fact that it goes 4 years into their school and she still feels that way, like, I don't know.
I mean, to me, that the idea of that relationship, which was really tossed in as an afterthought, because you can be in awe of somebody, but not romantically. So I could believe that Scorpius was, because he spent all his time, like, basically reading because he had no friends and Draco would, like, never let him out of the house, basically. Like, I could believe he would be in awe of somebody like Rose because she is so bright. But it almost, to me, felt like they wanted to kind of set up this, like, Lily James in school aspect with them, where, like, you did have somebody that was, like, a jerk but also really liked this other person, and they, like, hated each other, so they were like, go out with me no, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's very teenager to, like, like someone that doesn't like you, and, like, you just kind of, like the challenge, or not, like, I don't know if I said that correctly, but there's always that one person that you like that you think you don't get along with, but, like, you admire them from afar. And you never
we really know what's behind this. It's that residual Draco feeling for Hermione, liking to be bossed around all the time. It's trickled down. It's trickled down to the next generation, apparently.
He did admit that he enjoyed getting bossed around by her.
I will say that I liked, like, towards the end of the play, like, because there are some lovely moments when they're all in Godric's Hollow in, like, the 80s. And both Scorpius and Hermione have, like, the same, like, smart reaction to something. And Ron's like, when were there two of them? Like, there's two of them now. And I was like, oh, that's cute. I thought that was nice.
Go
on.
Rose was bearable when she first came on stage. She was the perfect combination of Hermione Granger and Ron. Like, she was literally, like, she was super smart, but she used her smarts to do, like, fiendish things and, like, to, like, break the rules, which I thought was great, and I thought that was really creative on their end. But after that, it just kind of fell apart.
Well, and that line on the train, which strikes some people as being very elitist, the whole, you know, our friends, our parents met their best friends for life on this train ride, because we are so famous, we will have our pick, you know, choose wisely. It seems really elitist. Then you think she's 11, and I think the line was probably, if I had to guess, delivered in a lot more, like, earnest. Like, oh my gosh, this is so exciting. Like, our parents met their best friends, and we're going to have to...
Yeah, that's exactly how
it was. Exactly, like, versus how it could sound. But then as the play goes on, she kind of just ends up being more like the second way anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you know what? Now that you mentioned that, that's probably what it is. Like, it was just something that, because we want her to be like Hermione 2.0 so bad, we would never think Hermione would say that. Right. You know? And so then you see it and you're like, oh, this is terrible. This is like Draco Malfoy first year. You know, you need to be friends with me because I'm the best.
The wrong sort.
Exactly. The wrong sort.
Don't want to be friends with the wrong sort.
That's exactly what she is. That's so funny.
You never know when it's being, you never know in this play, just from reading the script, you never know when they're intentionally, most of the time, you know, when they're intentionally trying to quote a line from one of the books or films, and it's more often than not the films or a video game. You know, sometimes I'd like maybe that, for instance, was a reference to the Draco thing. Maybe they're really trying to draw a comparison there. I don't know.
I mean, I think that would be interesting, because, like, you do see that, like, even though all of these children are, like, you know, the children of who their parents are, a lot of them do have traits that are, you know, that we usually would associate with, like, the past generation, like with Scorpius being, like, kind of brainy and, like, into books and a little bit nerdy. Like, that's, like, a very Hermione trait. So it was interesting to see that portrayed on him and not, like, on Rose, for example, or, like, you know, somewhere else. But I do want to talk a little bit about Albus and Scorpius, because we've kind of touched on them, but we haven't really, like, gone deep. How did we feel about these two, you know, in general? Did you guys like them? Did you like one more than the other?
I think Scorpius is kind of the standout character. Like, do you guys really like... Scorpius is winning all of the awards in terms
definitely.
Of...
Oh, yeah.
Because you just want to give him a hug.
Yeah.
He's, like, he's so adorable, and he has, like, no friends, and he just wants someone to share his candy with. Like, how can you not love
him? He sings about his candy.
That's right. He sings about his candy.
If he only knew that some of his candy was hand grenades, you know.
No kidding.
Yeah. No. Scorpius is great. Scorpius is probably the best thing to come out of this play as a character. He's so observant. He's so adaptable. He's gone through a lot, so he's not arrogant. He really tempers, honestly, he tempers Book 5 Harry, a.k.a. Albus Severus, quite a bit. And he's a, you know, a loyal friend. I really honestly feel that these boys should have been sorted, like Scorpius should have been sorted into Ravenclaw, and Albus should have been sorted into Hufflepuff. But, you know, maybe that's my too high expectations coming to light again. I would have really liked to have seen a story told from the other houses. Perspectives, but
I'm really happy to hear that you guys liked Scorpius on a script only basis, because one of my concerns when I saw the show was that it was the performer giving Scorpius all the love and making him so great, sure. Because I was worried that on the page he would appear to be soft and kind of like too dorky and unrealistic and kind of like random, you know. I was worried that people wouldn't necessarily understand him as well as we did when we watched the play, because Anthony Boyle I think if this show goes up for any awards, he'll win, like, best actor, because it was phenomenal. So it makes me really happy that it's not just Anthony Boyle's performance that makes Scorpius so great, but actually, like, actual Scorpius.
I mean, he's the one that's gone through stuff, you know? Like, this kid has actually suffered, whereas Albus is over here being super angsty over, like, what his middle child syndrome. I mean, yeah. I could never really relate much with him. Like, I didn't really like him that much, to be honest.
Yeah. I just, I think a lot of, you know, I can't really decide if I didn't like Albus or if I didn't like the almost forced conflict between him and Harry. Mm-hmm. Like, because it was almost like he went from 0 to 100, basically. Like, they have this tender moment in, like, the epilogue that we've read millions of times, where Harry literally tells him, if you're in Slytherin, it's okay. And then he gets into Slytherin and you know, like, it's almost like his, like, anger at his father just basically stems from what everybody else is, like, throwing at him at school. And I get that you should, like, resent your parents, but it's just, like, I don't know. And then I also didn't like the idea that, like, Harry couldn't relate to one of his children. Like, he can relate to all of them, but not to one. And then, like, he almost, like, spends so much time on Albus that it's like, well, what about the other two? Now you're neglecting Lily and James. So
That's exactly how I felt. I felt like Harry as a father was terrible. He was a terrible father. And I said that from day one. And I remember saying that, and I got a reaction from the other people who saw it. They're like, what? Like, no. And they try to explain his actions and his reasoning. And I'm like, no, like, it makes no sense. Harry would never snap at his child like that and say something so terrible, having not had a father. And especially after he's raised James so well, he already knows how to handle a kid. And Lily doesn't seem to be getting any of the bad karma or bad drama. So why is Albus getting all of it?
I mean, it's for purposes of the story. Like, because that's what drives the conflict of the play. It feels retconned.
Yeah.
It really does. This whole Harry and Albus Severus don't get along thing is bullcrap. Mm-hmm. This whole Harry not being a good dad is bullcrap. You know, build around the story. But I think, honestly, it's beyond that. It really does a disservice to Harry Potter. You know, this is the boy that welcomed death. He learned all about everything that he was meant to do. And you're telling me that, I mean, this is also, like, Albus isn't his first kid, okay? You're telling me that by the time Albus is off to school, 11 years he's had this kid, probably been a parent for, I don't know, 13, 14 years by now, and he doesn't know how to talk to his son or relate to his son or get along with his son. I have a feeling he would have been a little bit more invested from day one than the play, you know, really shows him being. And this whole, like, late night talk with Dumbledore's portrait to figure out what he has to do is so cheeseball, and it's so contrived. I want to start calling this the contrived child, because this is really just about who you can get to walk on that the audience is going to go, ooh, about. That's this entire play is just that, and that alone.
You know what? I think the only character that really made me, like, go, was Umbridge, because that's, like, the only one I did not expect. with Dumbledore and Snape, I loved that, like, I appreciate that they tried to give them closure, kind of, that we were never able to give. I appreciate that they put them there, because, like, obviously, like, you would think Harry would always want them to know that he, like, had so much appreciation for them that he named his child after them.
That's
but
so
they were
Snape
just so
apologies, though.
Yeah.
But they were so
out of character, though. I just couldn't believe, like, specifically with Snape, and I'm gonna, like, give it this a pass, like, a very nice pass, and say, well, it was alternate universe Snape, so maybe he just, like, spoke differently. But, like, the fact of the matter is, like, I never felt that that was, like, Snape.
He would never say that, absolutely.
He would never have said any of that.
No. But Dumbledore, didn't he kind of, like, joke about it? About his name, like, you're kind of putting what, like,
heavy weight on a shoulder.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I thought it was kind of jokingly, which kind of fit with what I would expect Dumbledore to say. unless he was saying it for real. Like, if he was serious about, like, I'm too great, you shouldn't have named your kid that because I'm the best. And, you know, like, naming your kid Jesus or something.
I did like that line, Dumbledore. It was really good. Actually, I cried, I got teary-eyed twice while reading the script. I imagine, and Kyle, you can support this and let me know for sure, but all the reviews I was reading, the spoilers and everything, said that there was not a dry eye in the theater at certain points, and that the really emotions in general of the audience were very high throughout. Is that true?
I think it was odd for me. Well, I get emotional, but I don't get emotional. So, like, I never cried once during this entire story, and even though I was totally expecting it to. But people all around me were definitely, like, you can hear sniffles during, like, the Dumbledore scene. A lot of people were kind of, like, emotional about, like, Harry connecting with Dumbledore again. And it was particularly evident, obviously, in the Godric's Hollow scene, where everyone was just bawling.
Yeah. I was going to say that I think I just... because we all have an emotional attachment to a lot of these characters. Like, when Dumbledore came back and Harry was able to have that conversation now that Harry's older and stuff like that, the idea of that made me emotional. I think I'd have to reread it and see if, like, I was emotional just because of the idea or if the dialogue made me emotional, if that makes sense.
It's probably more the idea.
Yeah.
This kind of been the first conversation that he had with Dumbledore.
Right. Sorry. But there were two points, like, there were two, like, actual scenes in this play that really made me, like, choke up because of what they were. And the first was in the alternate reality that Scorpius goes to, where Ron and Hermione aren't together. But then they realize that they could have had a future together, and they kiss before the Dementors, like, kiss them.
That had to have been terrifying.
Yeah, that got me. And then also the Godric's Hollow scene, but specifically Hagrid.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Like, coming to the house. That's the part where, like, it was ugly crying.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
It was bad. And yes. I can't even imagine, like, experiencing that in a play format. I think I would just be blubbering.
Hagrid, noticeably absent for most of this play. But when he shows up and he says, "Hey, little guy, you don't know what
evil stuff.
Yeah. You don't know what evil stuff you've been through, but I do, and that's why I'm going to be your friend." Like,
whether you like it or not.
Death,
you know what? I'm getting emotional just thinking about it.
I know.
Like,
I know.
Honestly, like, I start crying a little bit.
Yeah, drowning in my tears. Death.
Yeah, I do think the second part was more emotional than the first. Like, I personally liked the second part better than the first. The first, I was like, the whole time I was like, this is really just ridiculous. And then once I kind of just, like, accepted that this is what was happening, I felt like in the second half there were just more of those emotional connections, especially with Hagrid, and even actually, like, when Cedric saved them, I got a little bit emotional. I think I also, probably the idea of the thing, you know, like, actually going back and seeing this character again and him, you know, doing, I mean, just saving these kids' lives. Like, I just really, it brought a tear to my eye.
I mean, even knowing that he kills Neville.
That was the worst.
That was pretty terrible. You know, the thing about this, though, is that, like, this entire time, I've treated it as, like a Boy Meets World fantasy sequence. Like, do you remember those episodes? They just, like, be these completely
vaguely
characters. Mm-hmm.
And it was just, like, all fun and games, and it didn't have an impact on the plot, you know, and then it would just come back, and it was like, yay, we're back to just our normal selves. That's kind of how I saw this whole thing, was that, like, it wasn't good enough to convince me that any of it was real. So, like, it didn't affect any of the prior books at all, or, like, my view of them. And so it's just kind of this, I don't know, this little fantasy sequence. And then multiple ones in there, these alternate, you know, realities. And so, I don't know, it's just kind of I don't see it as part of the series, you know?
Yeah, I agree.
It's just kind of like this innocent sort of thing that's there, but that has no impact.
I think that's why during those scenes I didn't feel really that emotional, because it was just like, well, I know this is going to be retconned at the end of the play. Like, I know this is, like, they're not going to be die, obviously. So, like, you know, it was emotional for what was happening, but when it comes to the play, I was like, eh, okay. They'll be back.
Yeah, you're right. And I actually, this is a good time to bring up one of the listener emails that we got very quickly. I'm just going to read a little bit of this one from Amy. Part of it is in the doc if you guys want to read along. So she does start off by talking about how, like, as soon as she realized time turners were going to be a thing, she was like, that's it. I don't know about this. You guys, like, not really sure. And she ends with the sentiment that you guys just brought up, which was, I personally cannot accept the Cursed Child as canon, but I like the idea of it being a semi-official extended universe. Maybe I'll just pick and choose the parts I like and try to pretend like a certain character was never a thing to begin with. I'm assuming she meant Delphi, but I could be wrong. She says, thank you for letting me ramble. So sorry about the long message. Keep up the great work. Well, thank you so much, Amy, for that. We really appreciate your comments. But I think that you won't be alone in this. I think a lot of people are choosing to feel this way for sure.
It's just so interesting because, you know, J.K. Rowling has had, over the last month, complete and utter domination of the hashtag #KeepTheSecrets, really encouraging people to share, or not to share the gooey details. And, you know, she's really created this sort of, she's really kind of developed an ownership of the play in a way that wouldn't typically be apparent if it was just, like, something that she authorized, which it is. Like, three people have story credit and she did not write the play, but the way she's going about it really seems like she's, like, becoming an authoritative voice on the matter. And, you know, she recently said, what was it, yesterday, the Cursed Child, you should treat it as if it is canon. Like, she's answered this sort of blowback and pushback, not in any way that matters, but just to say, oh yeah, this is canon. And it just, you know, that's offensive to me.
I been curious.
Sorry. We all have something to say. It's crazy.
I know. I was just going to say very quickly, like, the good thing is that this does not tamper with, like, basically any part of, like, Harry Potter 1-7. Mm-hmm. And that's, like, all I really care about. Like, if she had done something that had completely changed, like, the events that we know it as we know them in, like, the first 7 books, I would have been, like, really upset. But I can, like, live with this because it doesn't really affect,
exactly,
you know, our original stories. That's all I had to say. Proceed.
Someone had mentioned in the comments on Hypeable, and I don't know which article they commented on, because we have like 8 or 9 Cursed Child articles up right now, but they said they consider it canon, but separate from book canon and separate from movie canon, as in it's its own little world. And I totally accept that. I can accept this being canon, because I may not like the choices, but I do like the majority of the characters and how they were, and I like that I can have them separately in my head. I can compartmentalize them as in book version, movie version, and now play version. So now I'm completely content with it being canon, because to me it doesn't interact with the movie or the books.
I like that enough.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm happy to take, you know, Scorpius and Albus and Rose and all of them in this form, and it doesn't affect, you know, the other characters who we really do know. Well, and actually, well, we're talking about the kids. What happened to Hugo?
We're Teddy.
Yeah, Hugo just disappeared. He doesn't.
He asked, and Carrie asks about him once, but we're just going to ignore a whole time.
We're Teddy.
Yeah, we're Teddy. Yeah.
They're the Aunt Peggy's of this play.
Yeah.
That's what it is. I do, you know, one character that is like has a bigger role that we haven't talked about is Draco. So I want to talk a little bit about him. How did you guys feel about his character in this? Was he more true to what we know, or would you like to have seen something different from him?
I don't know. Like, the scenes between he and Harry are good. I really actually quite enjoy how things are still a little bit tense between Draco and Harry. But they saddle Draco in this play with just such an impossible rumor to overcome. The whole, you know, your wife went back in time and banged Voldemort thing. Like, it's just so impossible to overcome that insane rumor that apparently is a real thing that's going around. And so the Harry and Draco tension at the beginning of the play is just colored by this being such an insane rumor that Harry doesn't want to do anything about, and Draco not able to get over the fact that it's just such an insane rumor. And, like, why even have this rumor at all? It's really stupid. and it's really, like, excessively fanficky. And if it weren't, in fact, you know, sort of a red herring for the legit real reveal that Voldy did have a kid later on in the play, I can't see a single reason why it should exist at all. So, like, Draco, he did great, but they just give him all this crap to deal with in this play that really, like, I think interferes with his ability to be a stronger character earlier in the play. Like, the end with him, part two with him, is excellent. But in part one, he just gets to be angry and shout things in public at ministry hearings because nobody's addressing his issue. Harry, again, is having problems presented to him that he literally does nothing about. Like, you can't even tell if he cares about them or not.
He actually went to sleep as his kid was missing. Like, did you notice that? Ginny's like, yeah, I can't sleep because my son's missing. Harry's like, ah, I'm just napping, no big deal.
You know what my favorite Draco moment was of the whole play was when they all reunited and he says, we can hug now too, if you like. And they share this awkward hug, which just made me think of that awkward Voldemort Draco hug in the movie. Yeah. Again, this furthers this idea that they clearly left some of these things in because of, you know, the movies and things like that, which, like, I understand because I guess you always assume that, especially, like, the newer generation is only going to have seen the movies, but it is kind of a disservice to the story as a whole, so yeah. It's hard. I think it's really, this is a hard book to digest, and I think, Andre, when we were talking about it before, you kind of said also that you felt like the, like, not necessarily that the writing wasn't up to like, Joe's standards, but, like, just, like, it was, like, kind of childish, that you felt it was a little childish?
Yeah, I mean, it was oversimplified, I think. Maybe it's because it was all dialogue, but I mean, I've read scripts that were good, you know. I mean, I've read plays, so I don't want to fully blame it on the fact that it's a script. But yeah, I felt like all of it was just oversimplified. The fact that all the scenes were incredibly short, that, you know, they had that convenient 5-minute limit on going back, or staying back, I guess. It didn't feel like it was Joe's at all. Like, I'm not really sure why her name is on it. Other than to, like, make it, you know, so someone doesn't get sued.
Right. It's so surface. It, you don't actually interact tangibly with any of the people that were in Harry's fourth year. In any real way. Like, it's not like the kids bump into Karkaroff and have to explain themselves why they're in Durmstrang robes. You know, like, they're not trapped in the past. It's impossible to be trapped in the past. It's got a 5-minute limit. You know, they can only either succeed or have to go back again and again with the time turner, okay? I did the math. I've said this on other podcasts. It would take 200,000 turns of the time turner to go back 25 years. There's no way in hell they sat there and turned the time turner manually 200,000 times. It's unrealistic.
Do they describe it in the script when they're doing the time turner? Do they say that they're turning anything, or do they say they just use it?
They use it, just like,
because the way I'm very surprised, because I feel like that's a very key thing that they need to explain in the script, because on stage, it wasn't something like a necklace. It wasn't Hermione's time turner by any way. It was like this thing that they put in the palm of their hand, and then they raised their other hand over it, and then it levitated and it turned on its own.
Huh.
Yeah. And it did this weird thing. It was not something that they were actually like turning. It was something that like magic was like doing it for them. So
that's amazing.
Yeah. So like, it's very odd that they wouldn't put that in the script, because I feel like that's a key thing to explain, because otherwise everyone's going to be thinking that they're holding like this necklace that they're like spinning around, and that's not the case at all.
You know, for some reason I in my head when this was happening, because I too felt like it would make no sense for Hermione's time turner to like have to, you know, have to sit there and spin, and like, what if you lose count? Okay, that's a lot of spins. In my head they like just pushed a button. It was more like a pocket watch thing, and they just like push the button in the middle, and like that was
like
that
the DeLorean, like time circuits on.
It's, you know. If it helps,
it's so
you
exact
is,
too.
It's
like,
sorry. It's kind of like a port key, where then everyone who's time traveling has to like put their hand in, and then, bam.
So magical technology has advanced.
Yeah, apparently.
That's very, very interesting. So we have, I think we've kind of gone through all the bigger characters, unless you guys want to talk a little more about Delphi and this idea that Voldemort and Bellatrix procreated at some point.
I'm not touching that with a 30 minute foot pole. I know. Not gonna do it.
We're just gonna let that be.
We're just gonna pretend like she doesn't exist.
Right. But one more thing we have to discuss in terms of this play is the idea of Albus and Scorpius. I know Kyle really wanted to talk about this. I'm gonna let you take the platform.
Well, before I go into it, I wanna ask Eric, when you were reading this, did you feel anything? Because as a heterosexual guy, I feel like you would read into it differently than me or than any of the girls that I've talked to about it. Like,
mm-hmm. And Andrew, we had done a Wormtaily episode of MuggleCast. It's just called Wormtaily. I think it might be hashtag Wormtaily. But I was familiar with his thoughts on the Albus Scorpius relationship as a result of that. And I'm not sure I read any spoilers where, like, somebody else was saying, oh, yeah, they're totally into one another, blah, blah, blah. But reading it, I tried to keep an open mind. And it turns out that that wasn't even necessary because it's absolutely 100% in there. I fully 100% support and back the idea that Albus and Scorpius would romantically be involved, if not during the events of the play because they're very young, then absolutely later when they grow up. It's very, 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 very much clear in both dialogue and stage direction. The stage directions say things like, Scorpius feels empty, you know, inside, and then he's fulfilled by Albus entering. And it's just like they're very... Look, I believe that you can have two males in a really, in like that are close friends, that are little, that allow themselves to be vulnerable as well. You can have vulnerable male characters without having them be gay, but I have to say I very much support the idea that they are or would be or are written that way because there's just so much of it. There's so much of it in this book. Absolutely, like, there's too much of it in this book. to have it just end with Scorpius asking Rose out is a complete and utter like sidestep or backstep for what they were going for. I think it's, I'm sorry, it's there's too much evidence to support that ship. I absolutely support it.
Yeah. That's like, when the book came out, I immediately tweeted like at midnight. I was like, okay, now that you guys have your scripts, you have to tell me if you see any gay vibes or if it's just on stage. Because on stage, like the actors, like oftentimes you guys know just by watching TV shows and movies, when two actors have chemistry, whether or not it's written that way, oftentimes people who are like really into it tend to like ship them because they just have so much good chemistry together, and that's it. And so I was worried that that was the only thing that was going on stage, is that the two actors just had this really phenomenal chemistry. And then when I talked to Andrew about it afterwards and I talked to everyone else, they're like, yeah, I totally see it. I was like, thank God. And so
Andrew talks about the scene where they're on the staircase and being pulled apart. You know, he talks about that scene a lot. Fine. But, like, even the early on years, like, we're talking part one, act one, when it's going through all the September 1sts that they share together. And, like, Scorpius's mom has, like, just died or become ill. And Albus is there for him as, like, a partner who's, like, you're supporting a partner whose mom has just died. You know, it really felt that way to me. Like, I wasn't trying to see this. I just did see it.
And it, the comments in the article that I wrote, when I did write an article explaining that this was like a missed opportunity to just kind of do some groundbreaking, like, you don't have to even worry about it, you don't have to explain it, like, let it just naturally happen when it comes to a gay-male relationship in the Harry Potter universe. A lot of people think that maybe they were written this way on purpose, and maybe J.K. Rowling is trying to actually recover from not revealing Dumbledore was gay. And I don't know if I feel that, and I don't know if that's just an excuse for those people that, like, worship the ground that J.K. Rowling works on, you know?
Yeah.
Or Rowling, sorry, I keep saying
her
name
this
wrong.
This would have been the time to reconcile you, like, to get over, to make up for the post-canonical out of Dumbledore.
It would have been a perfect moment for her to just be like, I realized what I did wrong, and I fixed it, and you're welcome. And now it's just like, why is Rose even in it? Like, mm-hmm. Scorpius just says something about her smelling like bread, and then he wants to ask her to a dance.
So stupid. It's so stupid. Ladies, what did you think of the Albus Scorpius stuff?
So I think that I totally, like, I got it. Because Kyle texted me, too, as soon as I was done. He's like, what did you think? I was like, yeah, I could totally see that. Like, there's so much evidence there. But, you know, I think that, like, we talk a lot about representation on the regular hype shows. Like, that's something that we do a lot here. And as powerful as it would have been for them to write, like, you know, in the script, like, there is no ifs, ands, or buts about it. Scorpius and Albus are gay and they're in love and it's beautiful. I think that even if they had just like left it alone and let you like infer for yourself that there's obviously some love between these two boys there, like that would have been fine. It would have been better than just like adding in Rose at the last minute. Yes. Because even if you didn't like ship them, you can't deny that that idea that was just haphazardly tossed in at the end just doesn't make sense. It like didn't make sense. They didn't lead up to it enough for it to make sense.
Right.
So,
see, I mean, I could totally ship it. Like, I see it completely. But I don't know that I agree that Rose is just thrown in at the very end. I mean, there are multiple times when they run into her and Scorpius is like a mess. Like, he's like melts when he sees her. Or at the beginning, I mean, yeah, there was like, they smell like fresh bread and he was just being all nervous and weird around a girl. And so I saw several times when I was like, yep, he has a crush on her, while at the same time I was also, you know, it's like sensing something between him and Albus. So I don't know, I would be all for them. I think it's adorable, but I don't know that Rose is like just a random thing thrown at the end.
You know what's weird? Oh, sorry, go on.
No, go ahead.
I forgot about this until, actually, I didn't know about it, obviously, until I read the script, but the relationship between Albus Severus and Delphi and Scorpio, where Scorpio gets, like, really jealous. Like,
yeah, he does.
Like, jilted lover-type jealous over the time and the affection that Albus is spending with Delphi. Like, it really, and maybe that's, like, just a way of saying, like, how young boys feel when their attention's being taken away. Like, I get that. I get that that's not in and of itself, like, a sexual thing. But to me, I was like, oh, you know, he wants to possess Albus's time. Like the more intimate, like, the affection, like, the banter, like, the flirting that Albus is doing with Delphi, he wants that for himself. Like, that's what I was thinking. That's what, yeah, I was reading.
And he was upset that Albus had sort of confided in Delphi. It was that deeper sort of relationship.
It was like, yeah, their secret. And then,
right.
Yeah. I think all that said and done, I think something that I feel like no one has really mentioned in any of the discussions that have been brought up on Hypeable is that this is very much the rehearsal edition script. And so we have no clue what they changed, because this is from when they had previews. And I'm very curious to see if that last line about Rose was kept at the end. I want to know what the people who've seen it after opening night think, after they've read the script and they've seen the play, because there's a lot of things that could have changed, and they may have realized that the connection between them was too strong in the stage directions, and they may have gone backwards or something. I don't know. But
forwards in this case, yeah.
Yeah. but it's going to be interesting when the final edition comes out. And that's really what I'm saving my money for, is to get the final edition script and see what they changed and what was different. Because I'm not going to be able to go back to London and see it again.
Hopefully it'll come to Broadway soon.
Hopefully.
Hey, supposedly they're already looking to bring it in 2017.
That seems quick.
Supposedly. But yeah, that's what everybody else said too. So we'll just have to wait and see. Somebody else also added in the J.K. Rowling's recent comments about her saying that Harry's done. Who was that?
Me.
That was you?
Yeah. Go on. I was just curious, because she says that she's done with Harry's story and that, like, she's not going to write more of it, and that his journey ends and it's done with Cursed Child. But does that mean that it's the new generation's turn? Like, is she going to continue to write Potter material? Because she did say, it's the new generation. That's her exact quote. So, I don't know.
I think it's a real low point. like an extreme low point to end Harry's story on.
Yeah, I agree.
Frankly, like it would have been better if Harry's story had ended with the epilogue, and showing that he had like was just completely separate from House Prejudice, having died to save the world, and he's just kind of enjoying being a parent and all was well. I think that would have been a much higher point to end Harry on than put him through all this crap, having him witness his own family's death from like down the street, you know, looking in. All the stuff that she puts Harry through in this play, not only being a bad father, but having to witness that and go through all that is just way excessive to me. And I don't think that I enjoy at all this addition to Harry's story in terms of for his character. So like when she says canon, like not, when she says like the story's done, I'm like, why not end it? So like, why did it need to go this far? That's me.
Fan service, I guess. But yeah. I mean, I feel like Harry was done. Like she says Harry's done as if like it wasn't, it was done with the seventh book. Like that's when it was done.
Yeah.
This story, I mean, it's not really about Harry.
That's true now.
But it brings his character. We ended the epilogue with Harry going, it's fine if you're in Slytherin. And then we end, I guess at the end of Cursed Child, he's fine with Albus being in Slytherin, but we still know that he really wasn't okay with it. He just said that just to be nice, and then it took him a lot of time to...
Do we really? Around. I don't know if I got that from the play.
I didn't either.
I never thought that he was disappointed. I think that he was worried after, like, unfortunately, because Albus looked so much like him, everybody's expectations were not what he was in real life. And I think as a parent, like, if your kid is being, like, bullied, basically, like, of course you're going to worry. But I never really felt like he was disappointed. I don't know. Maybe that's just me?
No, I completely agree. I mean, I still don't understand the conflict between them. Like, Albus is a teenager who's, you know, just being a teenager. Like, he's having a hard time, but I don't know that, like, how much Harry had to do with that. Like, the entire play, we see him trying with his kid. You know, he's, like, trying to talk to him. He's trying to give him a gift. Like, he's trying the whole time. I think they try to tell us that, like, he's neglected him in some way because he had so much work to do, but we don't really see that. Like, we don't see Albus, like, missing his dad.
Right.
So I still don't really understand the conflict.
Also, I mean, like, this, I call shenanigans on this whole Harry's done thing, because any story that continues with, like, Albus or any other member of the Potter Weasley family, like, we're going to see them again. Yeah. But did you guys, like, I mean, going into this, because she really made it, they really sold it as, like, this is Albus's journey, and it was Albus's journey, but did you expect Harry, Ron, Hermione, and Draco, and everybody else to have as big of a role as they did? Because I really thought we were going to see them at, like, the beginning of term and the end of term, and that was it.
Oh, yeah, I was fully expecting, like, the format of the previous books, you know, that go into school and they're leaving. And again, like, I bring up Boy Meets World because I see this with Girl Meets World now. Like, I was expecting that kind of, like, we're going to focus on these kids and, like, the parents are going to be in it because obviously they have to be, but this isn't their story. And in some ways it was, but then they brought back all of these other characters that I was absolutely not expecting. I think it did kind of take away from, like, the new generation's time. Because we didn't get to, I don't think, meet as many of them or, like, go in as in-depth as I would have liked to have gotten to know them.
Is there anybody that we didn't see that you guys would have liked to have seen? I mean, we saw so many people, but...
Neville Longbottom.
It can be, like, new and... Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
mentioned, but never right? seen.
Right. I wanted to see... It wouldn't have fit at all in this play. I had no place in this play, but Sirius Black should have shown up with Hagrid. When Hagrid's with baby Harry in the destroyed house. Remember, it's Sirius who lends Hagrid the motorbike.
Mm-hmm.
So any second after that scene ended, Sirius would have been knocking on the door, and that would have been probably one of the coolest things.
That would have been too much. Too many emotions.
Yeah, and then Harry sees Sirius. Everyone's holding his hands, and Harry sees Sirius. He just loses it and runs and jumps in a frozen lake. Because he lost Sirius to, you're right. That's who I was missing from this play. My answer is always going to be the same. Like, what book do you want to read? Oh, I want to read about the Marauders. Or what character do you want to see? I want to see
but you
more
know
Marauders.
What? you know what? Now that we've seen what happens with Cursed Child, I don't know if I trust anybody with the Marauders. Like, I don't know if I trust Joe.
Thank you.
Maybe I just don't want it.
Thank you.
Maybe this
Thank
is her you. Way of showing us, like, see, you really don't want more.
Yeah.
Like,
you know what?
This time, you don't want more.
You know what? If they're, like, so set on, like, this idea of, like, bringing in fanfic tropes, like, if they want to, like, decide that the Shoebox Project Marauders fanfiction is, like, canon, that's fine. That's, like, that's as close
I need to familiarize myself with that.
The Shoebox Project, it's been around forever. It's great. So I guess the last big question that we have here is, now that we've all experienced the story in some form, do we really feel like a play was the right format for this story to be told in?
Sure wasn't a script.
I think so. I think a play was a great and brilliant idea to bring another Harry Potter story back to life, but I think they should have chosen a different writer and a different story to tell.
It's also, I mean, like, the only thing that is sort of, like, I'm leaving it open. I don't want to say that, like, I absolutely hate it, because I want to see the play, and I feel like then I would know, like, you know, was it worth it or not. The plot itself is ridiculous, I think we all agree. But I think maybe the point of this isn't so much the story, but, like, the experience, like, going to the park and seeing, you know, going into Ollivander's and, like, getting the wind blown in your face and seeing the lights and stuff and just kind of, like, feeling like you're in this magical world. And so, like, in my head anyway, like, that's the point of this, was to feel it at a theater.
Yeah. And I think being at the theater definitely brings back all the nostalgia, and the set and everything that they do. Really, I walked out and I loved it. And Selena was like, "Really?" And I was like, "Yeah." It was. It felt like Harry Potter. It felt like I was back there, and it felt legitimate, I guess is the word that I would say. And it felt like it's something that blows you away in your seat, and you're struck with all these characters and all these moments, and it's just like, it's great to be in there. Maybe not to just know the story, because anyone who just is told the story is like, what the heck, but to be there. And if you guys think you don't want to see the play because the story is so terrible, like, change your mind, because it's worth every penny. Yeah. You know, like just because the story is so bad doesn't mean that the production isn't worth it. So please, like, don't think that you shouldn't go and see it. If you have an opportunity, go and take it.
And I think that even, like, as much as, like, we gripe because we care, you guys. That's, like, the one thing you should take away from this. We gripe because we care. This is, like, the thing we love most. So, obviously, like, we were never going to be 100% happy with it. Even if Joe had written this all herself, we would have had problems with it, I think. We did have one listener email about this particular idea of, like, whether or not a play was the right format. This is from Larissa, and she says, "So Harry and Albus's emotional struggle was a focus of the play. It was very plot-driven, had way more characters than it knew what to do with, and was massive in scope. As I read the script, it frustrated me to no end that we were moving so quickly through the scenes that should feel bigger and longer. All the wonderful little nuances and tense build-ups of struggles that filled the pages of Joe's novels are absent. I felt like the boys go off to Hogwarts on the Hogwarts Express way too easily. They've solved Hermione's riddles and got the time turner way too quickly. Scorpius escapes the horrific Voldemort dimension with little struggle. It took him 5 seconds to convince Snape to trust him. The boys came up with a blanket solution in 1981 and apparently broke into Bathilda Bagshot's house and found exactly what they needed to with no problems. I could go on and on. Maybe I only feel that way because I didn't see it acted on stage, but I don't know. The play is insanely ambitious, and fitting it into a huge story into this play, even with two parts, it felt like it was told in the worst medium possible." So this is kind of something that I could see would come off more in the format that we read it. But Kyle, because you actually saw the play, I mean, did you feel like this stuff was missing? Did it feel like there should have been more? Obviously, they're working with time constraints and stuff, but
yeah,
I want to hear from you about this.
The length of the play did it justice. I think I wasn't sitting there at the end of the play going like, whoa, like, that was just a lot of information. It was a lot of information, but in the moment, I guess maybe because I was so into it and so excited, I was like, my ears were perked like a dog. Like, I just, like, staring at the stage and, like, waiting for everything to happen. So I guess when you're really into a moment, that moment feels longer. And it felt like a very, very long play, and it felt like it was adequate. You know, even with two parts, I was really happy that it was done in two parts because there was so much to tell. And I don't know, I didn't feel it was rushed. I know it was rushed, and I know there are moments where they could have spent a lot more time. But all said and done, as a play, it felt like it was perfect. Especially because you're normally used to a play being like, I don't know, like an hour, 2 hours. You know, you're not used to a play being 5 hours, so maybe that's why it helped.
And I could see how it would, it kind of slows down maybe when you're watching it, because, I mean, just listening to a soundtrack from, like, a musical, it feels very quick because the transitions are just, you know, just like bang, 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 whereas when you're actually seeing a show, there's more transition, and it just feels like it flows much better than when you're just listening to a soundtrack. So I could kind of see how that might translate in this case.
Totally. So I think that about wraps up our main discussion on Harry Potter and the Cursed Child parts 1 and 2. Last little bit here. I know we talked a lot about our favorite characters, our favorite scenes, our favorite quotes and stuff like that. But is there anything that anybody wanted to toss out there last minute that they really enjoyed that we didn't get to?
I like the trolley lady a lot.
Did you?
Best part. Oh my gosh. Well, not literally, but she was amazing.
I think I agree with what Anderson said on MuggleCast, which was that it felt like J.K. Rowling had that tidbit of information stored somewhere, like back from when she was making the books. Like, what if the kids want to jump off the train? Oh, they can't do that. There are some safeguards in place. And the trolley lady is that representation of that safeguard. Like, I think it's like a really elegant solution. However, her dialogue is a little, it's like everything else in this book. Like, it's a little leaving something to be desired. She just kind of repeats herself, I think, right? Like, it's creepy because she, like, somehow manages to bring her entire cart up on the roof of the train and is still asking, anything off the trolley dears, anything off the trolley dears? And it seems like even the Ministry of Magic can't get answers out of her because she's so distraught over, like, probably just repeating the same thing about a link who gave her the job. Like, it doesn't seem like the character's done service even then. But the idea that the trolley lady serves a different purpose as sort of a double agent, has that extra job, I really like.
I just pictured her as like Edward Scissorhands, and I was just like, I don't understand where this came from.
I'm sure it's done, like everything else in this play, it's crap, but I'm sure it's done very well.
I would hope so, yeah.
It was magical. No pun intended.
Yeah. Well, speaking of things that were done in the play, we're going to do some listener feedback right now. You guys had a lot of questions specifically for Kyle, so we're going to treat this as our rapid-fire question segment.
Okay,
Kyle, are you ready for this? Because this is all you.
Oh, yeah.
Cool.
Okay.
Our friend Joel Gamache asked, did anyone read it and see it? Mostly I'm curious if anything was surprising in the script book. You kind of already addressed this, but go ahead.
Just Scorpius and Albus. Like, that was really surprising that it was in the stage directions. That's it.
Cool. Devra says, was Voldemort pronounced with a T or a silent T? Curious.
It was a silent T. They said Voldemort. Yeah, the entire time they said Voldemort.
All right. Alice and Olivia want to know, how did they go swimming and do the water scenes? Were the actors wired or was it a projection?
So for the scene where Albus and Scorpius had to jump into the lake, there was an actual tank of water in the stage, like underneath where the floorboards were. And so they removed like the floorboards and you see water at the like the top of the water. You don't see the tank. So that's how they did that. And then when it came to swimming in the lake and blowing up like their heads and stuff, they were wired and they were going way up there. Speaking of which, if you ever get a chance to see the play, don't sit in the very, very last row in the back on the first floor because the balcony will obstruct your vision of the very, very top.
Oh, wow. There you go.
Yeah, I didn't get to see the Dementors that appeared. But luckily, the technical box was directly to my left, and I was able to look at their screen and see what they were doing.
Oh, no way!
Yeah.
So maybe sit there if you want to, you know, get really nerdy about theater. That might be good.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, so speaking of other technicalities, what about the invisibility cloak? That's something else Alice is curious about.
That is the one thing that no one remembers that I've seen. I talked to someone who saw it 2 weeks ago. Honestly, I think they just used a normal cloak because it wasn't anything mind-blowing. If it was mind-blowing, I would have remembered it, but it wasn't.
I wonder if it was just, like, a black, like, is if the background's black and they just, like, cover themselves up in black, then you wouldn't see them?
Possibly. I honestly can't remember. And I've been trying to answer this question ever since you asked it and tweeted it, like, 2 hours ago, and I'm sorry. I failed you, and I will tweet you the answer.
Kyle, you're the best. Savannah wants to know, how do they do the scenes with Polyjuice Potion / Transfiguration?
Oh, you know what? That's the one I'm not going to answer because it's the most mind-blowing trick in the book.
Oh, love it. You're turning into a little J.K. Rowling.
If you want to see it and you have plans to see it, I don't want to spoil it for you because it's amazing. Awesome. But if That's you really want to know, then tweet me because I'll tell you if you want to know. But I don't want to spoil it for the people who are going to see it.
Okay, there's one more here from Laura who says, people talk about the live owl scene in the first scene. Was King's Cross the first scene you saw?
Yeah, King's Cross was the very, very first scene. And the live owl, our audience, the one that we saw, was the only audience to see an actual live owl fly across it because they cut it after the very, very, very first performance. Aww.
And was that in the first scene or was that in like the owlery scene?
Because they do have an owlery scene. It was like someone got a note. And it was really funny because the reason they cut it is the owl got stuck in the rafters and like didn't go to the place it was supposed to go and was just flapping around in the rafters for a good like 5 minutes. Yeah.
Okay. And then we have a couple of just like reactionary tweets here. Kyle, do you want to take those? It's just one more thing from Laura down there.
Yeah.
And then there's one from Nina and one from Beefish.
So Laura says, I think Cursed Child was a B on a scale of A to F. It was a fun read. I just did not look too closely at the plot. To me, it may be true canon, but I view it as official fan fiction. Yeah. Accurate. Do you want me to read all of them?
Yes, please.
Okay. Nina Chamberlain says, in book 7, hated camping chapters at first, now our favorite parts. Cursed Child is already growing on me in the same way. Hopefully this grows on people in the same way, too, because hopefully not everyone will hate it forever. And Beefish says, Cursed Child is Harry Potter's Gilmore Season 7. Aww.
Oh. You know, I heard it compared to Scrubs Season 9. Or like the ninth season of Scrubs.
That is also awful. Well, of course, Scrubs and Gilmore Girls. Well, you guys, that about wraps. Well, that basically does wrap up our Cursed Child special. We really hope that we didn't, become too much of Debbie Downers. But again, we gripe because we care. So that's something to take into consideration. And remember, there were some positive aspects that we liked. Like Eric was a big fan of the Trolley Lady. Kyle really liked Albus and Scorpius. Andrea and I both cried. It was great. what more do you want? We do want to remind you, of course, that we are Hypeable.com's flagship show. And as a result, we also have a lot of Cursed Child goodness going on Hypeable.com right now. There's so many features up about this play. So if you're looking for more of that in-depth analysis, please head over to Hypeable.com and check that out. There's also a great piece by Kyle, who wrote about Albus and Scorpius and how that was a missed opportunity that was very well written. And of course, if you want to get in contact with us, you can do so in many, many, many ways. We're going to run through our contact information very quickly for you. If you want to tweet us like all of these lovely people did before we started the show today, you can reach us at HypeableHype on Twitter. We are also at HypeableHype on Instagram in case you want to follow along on all of our pop culture related adventures that we have when we're not recording this show. If you want to hang out with us on Tumblr, we are over there as well. We are hypepodcast.tumblr.com. If you want to send us an email like Amy and Laura did earlier in this episode, you can do so by emailing us at hype@hypeable.com. That's the tongue twister. So it's hype@hypeable.com. And of course, you can always leave us lengthier comments in the show notes on the most recent episode for this podcast. Actually, for this, keep your comments in the Cursed Child episode because we don't want to spoil anybody that has not had a chance to, you know, see the play if they have tickets coming up or have read, you know, the book and stuff like that. Let's keep people spoiler free for at least another 2 weeks or so. I think that that's a nice amount of time to give people to enjoy this at their own pace. So yeah, and Eric and Andrea, thank you so much for joining Kyle and I. We loved having you. It's always nice to have guest hosts.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
And we'll have you guys on again soon, I'm sure. All right, guys. Well, that's it for us, and we'll see you very, very soon. We have like 3 episodes of Hype coming up. We've got the regular show getting recorded this coming week. We also have another one of our Gilmore Girls specials, so you'll be hearing from us very soon. And until then, we'll talk to you guys later. Bye.
Bye.